Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. In a few weeks, San Francisco Public Schools will open their doors to over 57,000 students and start another school year. We're pleased to have in studio the superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District, Richard Carranza, to talk about what's ahead this year for San Francisco Public Schools, students, parents, and teachers. Superintendent Carranza has been at the helm of SFUSD since 2012. Prior to that, he was Deputy Superintendent of Instruction, Innovation, and Social Justice at the district from 2009 to 2012. He holds a BA in Secondary Education from the University of Arizona and a Master's of Education with Distinction in Educational Leadership from Northern Arizona University. We're delighted to have him on the program today. Welcome, Superintendent Carranza.
David, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're also glad you, our listeners, are joining us, and in just a little while, we'll be opening up the phone lines at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us now at feedback@cityofvisionsradio.com or send us a message via our website or our Facebook page. The school year opening later this month. I know it's a very exciting time of year for you. Can you just give us an overview of the state of SFUSD as we enter the new school year?
Sure. Well, for all of us that are involved with the school district, this is kind of the Super Bowl, the World Series, and the ABA Finals all rolled into one. This is kind of what we prepare all summer for, and I'm very optimistic, and I think the organization is very optimistic as we enter into the school year. This is really the first year, at least in the 6 years that I've been here in San Francisco, that we haven't opened the school year where we've issued pink slips and we've laid off folks. So the economy has really helped us. The state of California has provided some additional resources through the LCFF. We've moved a lot of those resources directly to schools. So school site budgets should feel the impact, the positive impact. We're hiring. Just like the rest of the school districts across the state of California and actually across the country, we're seeing a teacher shortage, but we're working hard and we're very optimistic we're going to have a fully credentialed teacher in every classroom at the start of the school year. So a lot of things are happening in the curriculum front as well, the implementation of the Common Core. We also are seeing an incredible investment and, quite frankly, a rally around the schools in the community, the business community, the tech community, the philanthropic community as well. We are also continuing to see an uptick in enrollments in the public schools here in San Francisco. So, you know, the indicators look positive. We obviously have our challenges as well. Student achievement, particularly with students of color in San Francisco, remains an issue that we're focused on, and we are by no means are satisfied where we are. But we think that we are doing better at educating all students, and we mean all students. And we know that the road ahead is still a lot of challenges, but we're really optimistic that we've got the right people and we've got the right game plan to make it happen.
And just today, you announced some positive news that your graduation rates were improved. The original numbers had said that they had slightly dipped. So my first question is, what is the significance of the improving graduation rates? But my second question is, how was there an error and how did you go about fixing it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So we were really disappointed when the state released its four-year cohort rate. So the four-year cohort rate for determining graduation rates basically looks at who are the students that enroll their freshman year, and then 4 years later, who are the students that walk across the stage and get a diploma. So all of our high schools do an incredible job of tracking their students. They have lists. They're checking their lists. They're intervening with students. Students that need summer school are put into summer school. Students that need additional supports get those additional supports. So all of our indicators, all of our formative indicators indicated that we were going to have a bump in our four-year graduation rate. So when the state came out and said our graduation rate was 79.9%, which was at the time lower than the state of California's 81%, 5% graduation rate, we all felt like we had taken kind of a blow to the gut because it just didn't jive with what our numbers were telling us. So what we did immediately is we went back and we literally counted and tracked every single student. Well, what we found was that there were a number of issues that went into that. First and foremost, we implemented now 2 years ago a new student information system. And that's really the nerve center of all of our student data. And what we found were there were some issues with students that had certain demographic or programmatic characteristics. So if a student was an English language learner and went to summer school and had an after-school program, for example, in the program, it got bumped to a code that didn't get counted towards the graduation rate, even though that student had graduated. So we found a number of those cases, pretty significant, about 50 plus of those cases. And then because we have a new system, there were also some entering data errors that we found as well that we were able to correct. All told, we were able to find about 177 students that were inappropriately not coded for graduation. We found those errors. We were able to document the errors. We submitted those errors or the new data to the state of California, and they revised our graduation rate. So now we're close to 84%. But David, I think what's even more important is that that 84%, actually 83.9% to be exact, but the 84% graduation rate very much aligns with what our schools were already telling us our graduation rate should be. So it kind of reinforces the data tracking that we're doing at the school site level. But even more important is that the class of 2014, which is this four-year cohort graduation rate, was the first graduating class that had to complete an A through G college course sequence
right.
as a default curriculum for a diploma. So the bar was raised and the expectations were even greater on those graduates, and we had an increasingly higher graduation rate by almost 3% versus the previous year. So that really tells us that, you know, our teachers and our paraprofessionals, our administrators, everybody's working really hard. And also kudos to our parents and our students who really stepped up. And you know, if you have high expectations, your students will meet those expectations. So we were really excited that we were able to not only find the errors, but now that we know what those errors are, we've actually now implemented a series of double checks to make sure that doesn't happen going forward.
Got it. Now, you mentioned in your opening about the Common Core standards, and that's something that many of our listeners are hearing in the news a lot, mainly around the Republican presidential primary race, where they're falling over each other from red states to say how much they oppose Common Core. Of course, this is San Francisco. This is California. That's very supportive. But basically, Common Core, new learning standards in reading and math that have been adopted by most states. And can you tell us what the implementation has been like in San Francisco?
Sure. So if you don't mind, I'd like to maybe clarify just a bit about what the Common Core standards
are. Please do,
really,
because
are.
I feel like people are hearing so much misinformation out there. I think that would be a great place to start.
You bet. So the Common Core standards are, it's not this perverse plan by the federal government to take over local control of education. It's not that at all. It's really a plan that came from the governors of all of the states in America. They got together and said, look, in some states they have very rigorous state standards. In other states, they're pretty laughable. They're so easy. So there is really this disparate array of achievement across the country. So what was developed was through experts, they developed the Common Core State Standards. Now, the whole point of the Common Core State Standards is to raise the level of rigor that's required for students to be able to demonstrate not only subject matter knowledge, but also there are certain indicators that indicate whether or not they're college and career ready as well. And the previous standards did not take that into account. So it really raised the bar for everyone. In addition, you know, we've become accustomed to reading how the United States does not fare well compared to other industrialized nations around the world when it comes to math scores and science scores. The Common Core really was an attempt to really raise that level of expectation. Now, one last clarification is that when you talk about standards, standards just speak to what students are supposed to be able to know and do and demonstrate. The way you get students to be able to know and do and demonstrate is through through the curriculum. The curriculum that is written is what is taught in the schools. That is the vehicle to get students to the state standards or to be able to demonstrate mastery of state standards. What we're so excited about in San Francisco is, whereas in many parts of California and across the nation, where the Common Core state standards were driven top down, and by that I mean that a central office of curriculum and instruction somewhere in a district would take the state standards, write a curriculum that's aligned to those state standards, and then say, now you will teach this curricula at every grade level. We took a different approach in San Francisco. We took a classroom up approach. So what we did is we convened teachers to actually take the state standards and actually write the SFUSD core curriculum based on the state standards or the Common Core standards. What we have found now is tremendous, tremendous buy-in from our teachers and ownership from our teachers. So we have over almost 400 English language arts teachers from across the district that have written the core curriculum in English language arts based on the Common Core standards in San Francisco. Almost 500 of our math teachers from across the district, all grade levels, have participate in writing the state standards for math or the Common Core standards for math. We have a similar approach that's happening with the next generation science standards. So what's really happened is that the curriculum is iterative, and as teachers are implementing the curriculum, there are changes that are being made. There were incredible amounts of time this summer where teachers came together, took a look at the curriculum, revised the curriculum, developed new plans, developed new resources, new approaches. So it's an iterative process. But what I'm so proud of is that the teachers in San Francisco own the curriculum. And it's I like to say it's a good housekeeping seal of approval from our very own teachers. I think that's really made it different in San Francisco than in many other locations across the state of California and the nation.
And that just seems like such a skillful way to go about it, to get buy-in from the folks who are the experts in the classroom and to have them design it. Why do you think it's been top down in so many other places?
Well, I think there's been a lot of mandates about the Common Core state standards. So if the state in a particular state says you're going to implement the Common Core and you're going to implement it within a certain time frame, then there's this real push, because it's a seismic shift in what's taught in the classrooms. There's a real push to get it done and get it done quickly. San Francisco never really goes that route, which is one of the things that I really appreciate about being in San Francisco. So we took a much more thoughtful approach about, we're not going to completely throw out everything that we've done, because we've invested a lot of time and effort and our teachers have invested a lot of time and effort. But let's take what we're already doing. Let's look at what the Common Core standards require students to be able to know and do. And then let's have a thoughtful way forward so that we're developing a new core curriculum that's based on the Common Core, but doesn't always leave out what we were teaching in the past either. So there are some elements of the previous standards that are in our core curriculum, which we just feel is very much what San Francisco is all about. And I think a lot of this comes from the fact that many of us, and as a superintendent, I've made it a real focus to hire people into leadership positions that have been classroom teachers, that have been school site administrators. You know, I was a teacher for almost 10 years, and I still remember what those top-down mandates felt like and what it was like trying to implement that. So we always try to remember what that's like from the teacher's perspective and empower our teachers, because at the end of the day, you know, I may be the superintendent, but I don't teach any students in my day. The people that are teaching students are our teachers in the classroom, so we should treat them as the professionals that they are.
And can you give a specific example of two, or what some of the changes that these teachers developed in the change curriculum with the Common Core? What does it mean actually in the classroom?
Sure. So it's not okay anymore for students to have cursory answers where they can bubble in multiple choice tests. So now, and parents are going to hear a lot more about this, but students are required to describe their thinking. They're required to be able to describe how they got to an answer. So getting the correct answer is still important, right? 2 + 2 should still equal 4. But what's even more important than 2 + 2 = 4, which is a given, they should be able to describe why 2 + 2 = 4. And they should be able to describe that if 2 × 2 = something else, why is it that it equals something else? Now, that's where it becomes really complex, because students not only have to be able to demonstrate the correct answer, they have to be able to demonstrate and explain why they got the correct answer, and they have to be able to do this using new technology. So these are all, when you teach something, you have to measure whether students have measured it or mastered it. And the summative way of looking at whether students have mastered the standards for that grade level happens at the end of the year with the Smarter Balanced tests, the SBAC tests. SBAC is computer-based. It's adaptive, which means that as students are answering questions, it adjusts the level of difficulty, and that's accounted for in the report that parents get. But there are also aspects to the questions that are included in the SBAC that speak to whether students are developing a growth mindset, if they're developing a college mindset, college and careers. There's questions about how students are starting to look at their career. How are they connecting what they're doing in math class or an English class to a potential future career? So it's become much more complex. And I think that as I've spoken to teachers across the district, one of the things that I'm hearing is that there's great hope that the SBAC results will give teachers much better information upon which to build their instructional plans. Now, we don't wait just until the end of the year to do that assessment. There's a lot of formative assessment that happens throughout the course of the year that teachers are engaged in, that teachers are developing their assessments. So just like the example that I gave where our schools were telling us our graduation rate is going to be such a number and the results just didn't jive, that's exactly what we're doing with the formative assessments. We are tracking how students are mastering the subject matter. And then when the SBAC comes at the end of the year, it should just be a confirmation of what we've known all along.
Now, let's talk about kind of a related topic, which is the CORE initiative. SFUSD and six other school districts in the state banded together in a consortium called the California Office to Reform Education, or CORE. For 3 years, the CORE districts have been granted a waiver from the federal government for some of the requirements of the No Child Left Behind law. Could you talk about what CORE is and what advantages it's giving San Francisco?
Sure. So we're in some parts of the country and California, we're the crazy CORE districts. But basically what happened, David, is that when the educational administration, the federal administration, announced their first wave of Race to the Top applications, there were nine of us. Nine districts across the state of California that basically said it doesn't make sense for each one of us to go after those Race to the Top applications individually. Let's band together and let's collaboratively submit some applications where we're going to work together around the implementation of the Common Core, the implementation of the Next Generation Science Standards, etc. So we came together within a very short time period. I think it was about 3 months, and we had a facilitated process, and our curriculum and instruction folks in San Francisco worked with the folks in Los Angeles, worked with the folks in Sacramento City. What ended up happening was we didn't get a Race to the Top award. But what we did find out was that we were extremely powerful when we worked together and collaborated together. And we actually liked working together. And what came from that was a number of professional development opportunities for all of our teachers, a series of workshops and seminars. So we said, this makes sense that large urban districts would be working together in a collaborative way and sharing. So we share what we do in San Francisco with Fresno. Fresno shares it with us. We share with Long Beach, Los Angeles. So what ended up happening was that No Child Left Behind was pretty myopic. Now, there were some good things about No Child Left Behind, where all districts had to look at student-level data and subgroups so that no subgroup of students now could hide, right? You really shone a light on all student achievement. That was a good thing. But what was not good was that it was punitive in nature. So regardless of how much improvement a school was making. So if a student entered a classroom reading at a second grade level, and by the end of the year they had progressed a grade and a half, but they're still two grades behind, schools aren't given credit for that. You either make the bar or you don't. And if you make the bar, you're adequate yearly performance. And if you don't, you're a failing school. And by the way, parents can move your kids out of those schools. you never get a chance to really build capacity in those types of schools. I don't know about you, but I think that's just crazy. I think that's stupid. So what we said is, now that the federal government was giving the opportunity for states, and in the law it's written that local educational agencies, LEAs, school districts, could also write, we said, we're going to take that same approach of working together collaboratively, and as a collaborative of school districts called CORE, we're going to apply for district-level waivers from No Child Left Behind. So I like to say to folks is we sought a waiver from stupidity. And we had to agree that we were going to work together. We had to agree that we were going to set much tougher standards than what were even required from No Child Left Behind, that we were going to reduce disproportionality and suspensions. We were going to reduce the achievement gap or the opportunity gap for our students, that we were going to, whereas in No Child Left Behind, if you had 30 students of one particular subgroup, or less, they didn't even get counted. We said, nope, wherever you have 10 students, they count as a subgroup. So now we brought in, just with that, we brought in over 200,000 students under the light of accountability. And what we said, which was really important, is that we're not leading with punitive accountability measures. We're leading with developing capacity for the school districts to actually address the needs that are identified for our students. That was the whole premise behind us working together as CORE. So we applied. We were actually granted the first ever in the country district level waiver. We've been renewed twice. We're in the hopper for a third. But what's really come from that is, and I apologize for being so long-winded on this one, but what's really been exciting is that as we've been able to share our data across these nine school districts, there, if there's a school A in San Francisco that has a certain demographic profile, and there's a school B in, let's just say, Fresno, that has a very similar demographic profile, and school A is really doing great. The students are really achieving well, and school B is not doing so hot. Instead of naming school B a failing school and that's it, what we do now is we actually have the ability now to bring those two schools together, team them up, so that school B can learn what school A is doing that's having success. And quite frankly, what we've heard from school A is that they learn just as much, sure, being that partner to that other school in a different city in the state of California. So we're seeing some really positive collaborative relationships that are happening, and the improvement that comes with that kind of collaboration.
You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, I am one-on-one with the head of the San Francisco Unified School District, Superintendent Richard Carranza. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org. You can post a comment on our website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. I want to turn now to something else that's been in the news recently, which is the new system for student assignment and the data showing that San Francisco public schools have actually become more segregated under the new student assignment system. One third of the district's elementary schools are now, quote, racially isolated, composed of at least 60% of students of one race. Of course, the student assignment system has been debated for years and years and years and will be continued to be debated. There are a lot of things you're trying to balance here. But what do you make of this trend of having more, quote, racially isolated schools?
Yeah, so we're no one's happy with that. I think the Board of Education and most certainly myself, we're just not satisfied with racially isolated schools. I think it goes contrary to what we believe in as Americans in a democracy. Given that, however, we are a microcosm of the city within which we reside, and San Francisco isn't an integrated city per se. There are very, very much racially identifiable neighborhoods in the city of San Francisco. So for us, The challenge is that we know that when students are able to not only attend but prosper in a school that is diverse, we know that there are certain benefits that students take from that kind of an experience, not the least of which is that's what the world is. So for us, we've been trying to figure out what is the right system for incentivizing, supporting, empowering school communities to draw, because we have a full choice system in San Francisco. How do we incentivize and provide those opportunities for families to see value in a school that perhaps is a little farther down the road than where they live?
Because families of all races may have a bias, really isn't the right word here in that sense, but wanting to go close to home, wanting to be able to walk to school. It's more convenient and everything. And in the Chronicle article on this, one of your school board members said, "I don't know how as a policymaker to encourage people to make different choices, but that is what is going to have to happen." Mm-hmm. So you're sitting here as a policymaker. What can you do to encourage parents to be more open-minded?
Well, first and foremost, I think one of the things we need to be able to do is tell the stories of our schools, because I'm still shocked many times when I go out into the community and hear the perceptions that are out there about what certain schools are and what schools are quote unquote good and what schools aren't good. Now, I totally respect the fact that parents, you know, have certain choices they want to make, and that's part of a choice system. However, let me give you a case in point. Everett Middle School, and we've talked about Everett Middle School quite a bit in the school district. 5 years ago, Everett Middle School was not a school of choice. People did not want to go to Everett Middle School. And the word on the street was that Everett Middle School was a dangerous place. It wasn't a very rigorous place, that there weren't caring people there that would take care of kids. That was absolutely not true. There were some really hardworking people at Everett Middle School. But what we ended up doing at Everett Middle School is being very clear about what students were going to experience at Everett Middle School. The district invested resources through the school improvement grants at Everett Middle School. The administration there took it very seriously. The teachers actually did a really good job. But what was key, David, was that there were groups of parents that were coming from elementary schools that had a choice to go elsewhere, yet Everett was kind of their designated middle school. And what these parents did is they actually took the time to go visit Everett Middle School. They did their due diligence, and then they said, look, if I'm going to go and you're going to go, we're all going to go together, and we're going to make a difference at Everett Middle School. Fast forward to today, Everett Middle School has a waiting list for enrollment. They have great programs. They have great efficacy for instruction. They have a vibrant parent community. It's a diverse school in the heart of the Mission. I think that's a case in point, that if you provide a great experience for students and for parents, if you provide an opportunity for parents to authentically be involved in the decision making and what happens at the school, and people get the word out.
I was about to say, that seems to be a key part of it, because there can be great work being done, but if the parents who are applying, who are signing up, don't know about it, it's going to fall on deaf ears.
You're absolutely right. So that's a case in point where parents have now talked about what a great experience they're having at Everett, and they say, come on, you can come too. That has really turned the school around. Now, that experience is just one example of how we hope to be able to provide those additional opportunities for parents across the city. But I mean, you still run into the challenge that, you know, if word on the street or word on a particular listserv or blog says, oh, if you're going to go to elementary school in San Francisco, you have to go to one of these five elementaries, if not, go private. That's still out there. So as much as we can do to really highlight what schools are doing, I think that'll serve not only the schools better, but it'll serve the community better as well.
We have a related email from Denise in San Francisco, who asks, what is the benefit of desegregation if students choose to self-segregate in school classes and school cafeterias?
Sure. So as a classroom teacher, I saw that all the time. I think that segregation is a powerful word. I think that kids will gravitate towards students that have similar interests as they do. But the beautiful thing about education and kids in school is that sometimes they don't realize how much they have in common with other kids until you facilitate a way for them to kind of integrate and get to know each other. And there's a number of ways that happens. Arts. The fine arts and the performing arts are a great way of students integrating. Athletics is another great example of how that happens. Extracurricular activities is a great way that happens. Blended classrooms where you have different kids of different, for example, inclusive classrooms that we have in our district where you're not segregating out students with disabilities, but as appropriate, you're including them and mainstreaming them into the general education classroom. Incredibly powerful experiences that happen and some really great connections that happen as well.
You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're joined by SFUSD Superintendent Richard Carranza. Again, we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to join to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsklw. Let's now go to a call from Scott in San Francisco. Scott, welcome to City Visions.
Good evening, gentlemen, and thank you for taking my call.
Thanks. What is your question for the superintendent?
So anyway, I'm 65 years old, and you people like the superintendent have been dealing with this situation for the last half a century. I can see that some progress is being made, but I wonder if it's all pie in the sky, trying to make sure that every student has the same educational experience as the other student. When they don't have the same background to start with, and they have a great difficulty in keeping up with the work.
Thank you for your call, Scott.
Sure, Scott. So thank you for the question. I think a couple of points here. So I think that if we truly believe in a democracy, then I don't think we can give up on that. I think that it's very important. The future of a democracy depends on a well-educated population. If you look at the demographics across not only the state of California, but across the nation, the population is becoming much more diverse. So I think that if we can figure out how to do that in San Francisco and in California, so will the nation follow. But I also think that, you know, we have a choice to make. We either believe that certain kids are expendable and that we shouldn't waste our time or resources on educating them, or we believe that we have to create systems, which is what schools are. They're systems of forward movement in society. We create systems that identify who needs additional assistance, and then we differentiate that assistance to those individuals, because in America, we don't exclude people from moving forward in our democracy. I think that's really the genesis of what we're trying to do in San Francisco. And quite frankly, colleagues of mine across the country in large urban districts are doing the same thing. It's either the kids' fault or it's the system's responsibility to really respond, because if we don't have an educated populace, and the population is becoming much more diverse, then what does that portend to our democracy going forward? I think it really is a matter of democracy for us.
Well put. I want to ask now about kind of the philanthropic interest in SFUSD. We're going through enormous changes in San Francisco right now that are causing a lot of social tensions. There's enormous wealth being generated, and there is a debate about how much of that wealth is and should be kind of put back into the community. Can you tell us about SFUSD's efforts to work with some philanthropic leaders of some of the high-tech companies that have been very successful here, and what kind of response you've gotten in terms of investments in San Francisco's future, in our children, so as you were just saying, all of our children can succeed?
That's a great question, David. I think we're very proud of the work that we're doing with not only our philanthropic partners, but our business community, the Chamber of Commerce here in San Francisco, and the tech community, SF City. They've been fantastic. But I think we had to take a look at ourselves first. So 3 years ago, when I was appointed superintendent, one of the first things I did that first year was actually go and meet with business leaders and philanthropic leaders across the city and asked a very simple question. if we're not partnering, why aren't we partnering? And if we are partnering, how can we partner better? And what came from those conversations was absolutely illuminating. We weren't very good partners. We didn't have a clearly identified vision of where we wanted to go. In the past, we had partnered and not followed through with some of our commitments to those partnerships. So what we did is we actually brought together for a year-long facilitated process something that became known as Vision 2025. And the premise was very simple. We took the idea that in that year where we had the process, the kindergartner that walked in our classroom, in our kindergarten class, they would graduate in the year 2025. So the question was, what world in San Francisco, California, the United States, and the world, what world will they graduate into in the year 2025? And remember, we don't know what that's going to look like. And are we preparing students to be competitive in that kind of a global, geopolitical, global environment? So it was a tough question that we asked. But what resulted from that was Vision 2025, where we've clearly identified what a graduate will look like and what are the skills and compositions and things that they'll be able to know and do. What will that look like in the year 2025? And we also backwards mapped the 10 things we need to do to make sure we get a graduate of that caliber. Now, why do I mention that? Because as we've now gone out into the tech companies and to the business world and the finance market and the philanthropic market, and we talk to individuals, you know, businessmen like to know what is your plan. And we can talk about Vision 2025, our graduate profile, and then I can ask the very simple question, but not simplistic question. Would you hire a graduate that had these skills and dispositions? Universally, everyone has said, absolutely, we'd hire somebody like that. Then help us build that kind of a system in San Francisco. And people are on board. Now, with that, we've been very fortunate that Mayor Lee has been a real champion of the public schools in San Francisco. So with his assistance, we've actually started engaging our tech community. Mark Benioff has been phenomenal. Zynga has been fantastic. We have a number of organizations, and Zoom has been incredible. Clever has been fantastic. Twitter, Facebook, I mean, all of the big companies that you would think of. But what they've started doing is not investing resources in the form of tablets or computers or stuff. What they've actually done is work very closely with us to identify how do we help build capacity for teachers and the school system to use the stuff so that students can demonstrate their learning in a different way and teachers can teach in a different way.
Can you give some examples of that?
Yeah, let me give you a great example of that. So in our work with Salesforce, they've invested, as of this year, close to $13 million over the last 3 years in our middle schools, middle grades. So one of the things that I saw a year and a half ago was teachers were brought back and they did a 2-week boot camp to learn how to use software on these new devices that they were going to have in their classrooms. So they had this 2-week boot camp, they learned how to use the devices and the software to teach in a very different way. So on this particular day, I happened to go to a middle school in our city. And on the day that I went, students were demonstrating the difference, physics unit. They were demonstrating the difference between velocity and speed. Now, a lot of things had happened before I came to observe that day. But typically what will happen is you're going to do a unit on velocity and speed. So you'll take out your textbook, you'll turn to chapter whatever, you'll read what the definitions are, and then you'll answer the odd questions at the end, and you're done, right? Whoever gets it, gets it. Whoever doesn't, doesn't. Well, on this particular day, what had happened in advance is that students had done some of that research about what is velocity, what is speed, what is the difference. Then what they had done is they had already developed a class rubric for presentations that they themselves had a voice in creating. Students were using tablets and they were using a software called Edmodo, which allows, it's kind of like a Facebook type social media application in the classroom. So students are able to use that to give each other feedback. So on the day that I visited, students had been grouped into groups of two, and they had been given 3 days to go out and actually create an iMovie of no more than 5 minutes demonstrating the difference between velocity and speed. Not defining it, demonstrating it. So the day that I visited, students were going to show their iMovies. So students walk in. There are no rows. Students are kind of all over the place. They grab their device. They log in on the screen. I see the screen come up. I see everybody's logged in. Teacher calls the first group. The group comes up. they press play and they show their movie. And one student is sliding across the hallway, and then somebody's narrating, this is what velocity is. However, if he was doing speed, we were measuring speed, this is what he would be doing. Beautifully done. And as that video is showing, students in the class are giving real-time feedback to their colleagues that's showing up on the screen. The teacher facilitates that by then taking those comments, giving it back to the students, and saying to the students, within 48 hours, you have to turn in your final project for a grade. Now, think about what just happened here. The student, the teacher was not in front of the classroom, you know, drilling and killing. That wasn't what they were doing. Nobody filled out a bubble sheet on that day. Students were using motion. They were being creative. They were working in teams. They were using higher order thinking skills. They were able to interpret what velocity is and what speed is and be able to describe it and talk about the difference between the two. Students were giving each other feedback and analyzing each other's work. Students were using software to be able to demonstrate that in a very, very high resolution kind of way. And then students are given the opportunity to take the feedback, redo, and make it better, and then submit for a final grade. I don't know about you, but I'd hire those kids every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Why? Because they can demonstrate teamwork. They can demonstrate creativity. They can demonstrate deeper thinking. They can demonstrate higher order thinking skills. That's but one example of how the investment in our middle grades and the investment of the tech community is really helping us in San Francisco. Now, the other thing that I would say is that if you talk to anybody in the tech community, they're going to say one of the biggest challenges that they have is diversity, not only gender diversity, but ethnic diversity in their workforce. They recognize it. They know about it. They're talking about it. So when we bring our tech leaders in San Francisco into the classrooms of San Francisco, it's a diverse environment. So what is the solution to your diversity issue? They're sitting in our classrooms right now.
Absolutely, right in your backyard.
Right in our backyard. So why are you recruiting across the world where you can be investing and developing here? And I'll give you one more example. Zynga has been great because they've invested in our gaming academies. So we have two gaming academies, one at Balboa High School, one at Thurgood Marshall High School. Zynga has invested with their programmers to come in and run camps with our students. They've actually loaned one of their programmers to teach those gaming academies and then help our teachers in those schools to develop capacity to teach them. The students recently had a demonstration where they demonstrated the games that they had developed. And one of those groups of students actually had their game bought by Zynga. Zynga's going to take it to market.
Wow.
Now, if I'm a student, why am I doing math? Why am I doing science? Because I get to use it in this thing called game design. And they're using a program called Python. I don't know what Python is, but evidently it's like the cat's meow for programmers. But they're using this very sophisticated program. They created a game, and now it's going to market. It's a great example of how powerful that can be for our students.
You're listening to City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Today, we're joined by San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Richard Carranza. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. You can call us at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Now, you were just talking about what a graduate looks like in 2025, what businesses would be looking for. And it's not just the academic smarts, but it's the ability to work in teams, to work in groups, to get along with other people. And I know that you've made social-emotional learning a big part of the curriculum in SFUSD. Can you talk about some details of what that means and why you think it's so important in students' development?
Sure. So going back to the accountability system that we developed as part of our waiver from No Child Left Behind, we developed an accountability system in which 60% of our accountability system is based on academic indicators, but 40% is based on the development of social-emotional capacity in our students. Now, some folks may say, why is that so important? Well, if you're a well-adjusted adult, and I'll use that term in quotes, if you're a well-adjusted adult that has some semblance of success in their current situation, you've been dealt some setbacks in your life. You haven't got the job you applied for. You've maybe lost a job. You've had a hard time in school. You've had a hard class. Something has happened where you could have given up and said, I'm done. Yet you've been resilient. There's a grit about you that says, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to come back and I'm going to do it. I'm going to make sure I get that other job. That is social emotional competence that we want all of our students to have. The ability not to give up, not to think it's hopeless, the ability to find another way to be successful is social emotional learning.
So now, how do you teach that to students?
Well, what you do is you support that work in the classroom. So, for example, when I gave the example of the middle school classroom where students had done this incredible work of developing their iMovies and they've presented it and then they get feedback from their cohort, from their fellow students. And perhaps that feedback isn't as positive. Perhaps they weren't as clear as they thought they were. Their vision wasn't as clear. So they're given that feedback and then they have to take that feedback and redo their presentation and come back. Some kids would probably be inclined not to redo it. I've already done it. Give me the grade I get. But for the student to then be supported and say, you've got 48 hours, take this feedback, redo it, resubmit it for a higher grade. That's resilience, that's grit, and that's being encouraged by the very processes that the teacher is employing in the classroom that supports that kind of a developmental skill. Now, what we know in the research is that students in certain households get that kind of reinforcement all day long. And we know that there are students in certain high schools that don't get that kind of reinforcement. So if we really are creating these environments, which we call public schools, that are encouraging students to develop pro-social, very, very high-level kinds of skills and dispositions to be college, career, and life ready, then we know that we have to encourage those kinds of practices so that students don't give up, that students are sticking to it. And then the challenge becomes, David, then how do you, number one, how do you measure it?
You know where I'm going with my next question, yes.
So you got to be able to measure it. And if you're going to measure it, you better be able to describe how you're going to teach it and encourage it.
Right.
And that's part of the collaborative work that we're doing with the core districts where, fortunately, there's a lot of work that's being done in this area across the country. And we're taking the best learning from across the country and really starting to operationalize that within our classrooms.
I'd like for you to talk a little bit about African-American students in the SFUSD system who have underperformed by almost any measure compared to their peers. And it's something you've really made a focus. You've initiated the African-American Achievement Initiative. Can you tell us about that, about the recent hire you made, and about how that is going so far?
Absolutely. So if you look at the history of African-Americans in San Francisco, it hasn't always been the most illustrative history of our best intentions in San Francisco. So what we have found is that in our students and in our families, especially African-American students, there's been a deep mistrust of the system, which in many cases hasn't served the community very well. What we've tried to do is be very, very transparent about the fact that we want to serve all of our students. And if you look at the data, who are the students in the system that are not benefiting from all of the benefits of the system? It's our African American students. And we know that with the issues that are happening around income inequality, the issues around housing, the issues around affordability in San Francisco, there is an out-migration of our African-American community here in San Francisco. So what we said is instead of making excuses for it, that we're going to take this on, that we're going to work very closely with the city and county of San Francisco, we're going to work closely with the neighborhoods and the community, and that we're going to actually put a focus from an equity perspective on reversing that trend. Because again, we believe that everyone should have a place at the table in San Francisco. So what we've done has been very clear. I just hired a special assistant to the superintendent for African American Student Achievement and Leadership. He is a San Francisco product, product of San Francisco's public schools, Landon Dickey. He went away to Harvard College and got his MBA at Harvard, was a special assistant to the mayor in Boston, and we stole him back. I like to joke, we sent Boston Pablo Sandoval and we got Landon Dickey. I think we got a better
and
deal.
Pablo's not doing too well this year.
We got a much
right.
better deal. But what he's been doing is not to be the savior of African-American students in San Francisco. What his role has been is his full-time job is to work across the divisions in the district, the departments, to weave together this comprehensive fabric of how we're not only identifying what supports should be in place for students, African-American students and their families, but also working across Van Ness with City Hall and identifying what are the resources and the efforts that are happening in the city and county of San Francisco that we can leverage around our students, African-American students. For example, we know that if a student is facing homelessness or a student is in public housing, there are certain challenges that don't necessarily pertain to the school district. I mean, we don't run public housing, but we know the city does. And we know that there are resources that we could put in place in those organizations that can help with our African-American student achievement. So what we've done is really lifted up this issue, and we're in the process right now of bringing people to the table so that we have a comprehensive fabric that we're weaving on how we're going to support and provide equity support to our African-American students. The other thing that I will say is that if you talk to any African-American family in San Francisco, they are sick and tired of hearing just how in danger the African-American student is in our system, in our city, in our schools. They don't need to hear that. So we're trying to flip the narrative as well about African-American students. We know that there are some challenges, but we're also lifting up these incredible bright spots that are happening in San Francisco's public schools, where African-American students are not only attending school, but being very successful. They're going on, they're graduating, they're going on, they're getting scholarships, they're going to college, they're doing great jobs. So we're also going to lift up those examples to show and actually to learn from what are the schools that are doing a great job. I got to get a great shout out to Wallenberg High School, for example. If you look at the African-American student experience at Wallenberg High School, it's incredibly positive. Those students are on track. They're graduating. They're going to college. So it behooves us, and part of Landon's work is, what are you doing? How are you doing it? How are you structuring it? And how can we take that and then bring that to scale as well?
And then Landon himself is the perfect positive example.
He's a great example of that. Grew up in the Bayview. He's in San Francisco. He wants to serve his community. I think the other thing that's important about this is that San Francisco is not alone in this work. We belong to a national organization called the Council of the Great City Schools. And it is what it says it is. We are an amalgam of the largest urban school systems in America. We're urban school systems. And urban school systems have particular opportunities and particular challenges. We all have signed a pledge that has been delivered to the White House to President Obama that we have signed on for my brother's keeper. Although in San Francisco, it's my brother and sister's keeper, because we're not going to leave anybody out of this. But we've all committed that this is an issue that is of particular importance, and we're all working together, sharing each other's best practices as we go forward to really make a difference in this regard.
And speaking of working together in this regard, you've talked about working with the business community. Can you talk about what it's been like to work with the community-based organizations in San Francisco? There's a robust community-based infrastructure here that has not always had the easiest time navigating with civic government and with SFUSD in particular. So when you came in, how did you begin to build trust, and what kind of success have you had working with the community who are working with your kids after school, and you obviously need to collaborate with them to have successful outcomes for our children?
Yeah. I've just got to say, I love our community-based organizations. I mean, in San Francisco's public schools, we interact with over 300 community-based organizations on any given day, right? So they are a part of the fabric of our community, and we value them as a partner. But I think that the conversation that has evolved, at least in my 6 years in San Francisco, has been one of getting on the same page for results. So what we've done, and especially with the recent authorization of the Children's Fund, the reauthorization of the Children's Fund and the Public Education Enrichment Fund, it's now reauthorized for 25 years. But what's so important about that reauthorization is that we've ask the question about results. So what's the accountability? So what are we getting for the investment? So we are now talking about a shared outcomes framework in the city and county of San Francisco. So the mayor is chairing the city side, I'm chairing the district side, and then the people that really do all of the heavy lifting, our staffs, are working together to create an outcomes-based framework for children and youth in our city. our community-based organizations are incredibly important in that regard because they are embedded in our communities. They're embedded in our neighborhoods. They're doing the work and in many cases have been doing really heavy lifting for a number of years. Now, what I hear from our partners is that in many cases, they themselves have been frustrated that we haven't coordinated in a really robust way. So they're at the table, they're helping to define what those outcomes are going to be, how we're going to hold each other accountable for those outcomes. And I'll tell you, the case in point is the work that's being led right now around African-American student achievement and leadership, where we have a number of organizations that are doing phenomenal work that for the first time are sitting in a room together around a table, looking at data, developing outcomes, and then holding each other accountable without the threat of, well, if you get a dime, that's one less dime for me.
Right.
They're really taking this to a whole other level, which I'm so proud of.
We only have a few minutes left, but one thing that I do want to touch on, another change that's come about recently is in your school discipline process. And San Francisco had suspensions and expulsions that were increasing, mm-hmm. There were significant disparities in those suspensions and expulsions. The school board and others led an initiative to begin a more restorative justice process in the schools. And, you know, to me, suspensions have just never made sense because if you have someone who's acting up in school because he doesn't want to be there, and then you say, okay, guess what? You don't have to come to school. Not much of a punishment there to change behavior. Not much you can do with a kid if you don't have him in your school during those days. So we only have a few minutes, and I know we could talk for a long time about this, but I'm wondering if you could talk about what the new restorative justice process is and the benefits and challenges it's had for the district.
Sure. So I think if you start from the premise, David, that you want kids to be in school, and the best place for a student is in a classroom with a well-trained teacher that is looking out for the best interests of students, then how does that educationally make sense then to kick them out? It doesn't make sense. Now, what we have found is that in some cases, teachers just haven't had the skill set in terms of the tools in their toolbox. They haven't had the training to find a way to redirect behavior. Remember, kids are growing. They're developing. They don't have it all figured out. Heck, there are adults that haven't all figured it out. But how do we take an educational approach then to get students to recognize what they've done that's wrong or antisocial, and then get them to take ownership for that and then make amends for it? That's the genesis behind restorative practices. So we've invested heavily in that. We've also invested in positive behavioral supports training for our teachers. We've invested in pro-social emotional learning for our teachers, training for our teachers. And then quite frankly, the board has been extremely powerful in saying, we will not kick kids out of our schools. They should be in school. And you don't need a better example of what happens when students are kicked out than Trayvon Martin. I mean, let's go back. Trayvon Martin was killed, but he was killed because he had been suspended from school. Now, had he been in school, perhaps through a restorative process, he might still be alive today.
Richard Carranza, we just have about a minute left, but I'd like to give you an opportunity in closing to really talk about what you're most excited about in this upcoming school year.
Wow. Only a minute. I am just really, really excited about just this this energy that is really swelling in San Francisco for its public schools. I think in some cases, San Franciscans are rediscovering the incredible public schools that you have and that you support right here in our city. And in many cases, people that have been really, really supportive for a very long time are seeing the fruits of their labor come to fruition. So in partnerships, in the level of rigor that we're requiring for all of our students and that our students are meeting that level of rigor, in the incredible educators that we have in our classroom, the support that we're building for our educators, that is just incredibly, incredibly exciting for me, not only as a superintendent, but I'm a parent. I have a student in the school system and a graduate that just graduated a year ago. So I'm incredibly proud to have this opportunity to really share that the news with my fellow San Franciscans.
Superintendent Carranza, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
That's City Visions for this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Denny Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Next Monday, we will air a rebroadcast. My co-host Joseph Pache will be back in 2 weeks' time. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.